So I'm going to be talking about the metallicity distribution of globular clusters mostly, and in one particular case I'll talk about, well, and I'll talk about a link to some of the things you heard about a little earlier. So I'll split the talk into two parts. The first one is I'll be talking about low mass X-ray binaries with globular cluster connection and what you can tell about how low mass X-ray binaries, globular clusters, and their host galaxies form. One of my main interests is if we can use all of these things to try and figure out how galaxies form at some level. The second part of my talk will be about mass metallicity relationship, and there's something called blue tails. But what I really want to know is we have these metal poor clusters out in the halo, and these are some of the first things that formed in the universe. And so how universal are the properties of these metal poor clusters? Do they know about which halo they're formed in? Do they know where they were created? Do they know which kind of galaxy they would end up in? So there's just a couple of lines which I probably didn't need to do because the talks before this about what low mass X-ray binaries are, but not everybody does X-rays here. So low mass X-ray binaries are either neutron stars or black holes that are accreting from a low mass companion by Roche-Loeb overflow. They're really compact, and the ones that I'm going to be talking about is they're mostly, we are mostly observing them down to 10 to the power 37 ergs per second, which is how far you get in a typical Chandra observations. And quiescent low mass X-ray binaries can actually, they can go lower than that too. So if you assume that they've been on for the entire time, then the upper bound of a lifetime is 300 million years for about a 10 to the power 37 for a steadily accreting source. You can always change the lifetime by getting it on and off. So that's kind of a brief introduction of low mass X-ray binaries. Okay, so when we look at the Milky Way, when we look at the low mass X-ray binaries in the Milky Way, what we find is low mass X-ray binaries are preferentially formed in the globular clusters, and we've heard this before. They're a few hundred times more efficient. There's a few hundred times more low mass X-ray binary per unit stellar mass in globular clusters as compared to the field stars. And the belief is they've been formed dynamically, but exactly how dynamically is still a matter of conjecture. There's lots of different dynamical processes. There's collisions, there's exchange interactions, and many other things. There's accretion-induced collapse and many things. So what I've mostly studied is distant ellipticals. And the reason you want to study distant ellipticals is they have really rich globular cluster systems. Some of them are as much as two orders of magnitude more rich than the Milky Way. And they basically span a larger range of cluster properties beyond what you have at the local group sample. And you don't have dust and star-forming events for the most part, even though we heard otherwise. For the most part, there's less confusion. Wrong laptop. So this is an image from the first paper that Tom and Steve and I wrote on NGC 4472. And this is a bunch of WIPPIC2 pointings. This is a Chandra pointing. The red points are all X-ray sources. The blue points are the X-ray sources that happen to be in globular clusters. And what we found was about 40% of low mass X-ray binaries are in globular clusters, but 4% of globular clusters host LMXBs. And that's just a technical detail that you get really good matches. So this is what we found, and this is from our initial paper in 2002. And if I look at the plot, we could probably have stopped there because the mean properties of elliptical galaxies turned out to be very well represented with this galaxy, and you have pretty much everything that we know about low mass X-ray binaries in globular clusters except the details we heard earlier. The general trend that we know about is all there in this one galaxy. So let's go over this plot. So this is the radial distance from the center. That's the V minus I color. That's the bimodal V minus I color of the globular clusters. These are the low mass X-ray binaries, the bright points, and you see there's fractionally there's more low mass X-ray binaries in the red globular clusters than there are in the blue ones. It's a factor of three once you normalize them. The low mass X-ray binaries are preferentially in the most luminous clusters, and there's a weak correlation with the half-life radius. Some of the ones with the smallest half-life radius have preferentially more low mass X-ray binaries. And the relative importance after you do the statistics actually goes in this order. It's the magnitude of the mass, the color, the distance, and the half-life radius. Essentially, they're statistically negligible or close to it. So the most surprising, you expected some correlations. You expected dense clusters would have more low mass X-ray binaries, you have more interactions. Massive clusters have more stars, more interactions, you expect more low mass X-ray binaries. But one of the surprising correlations were that when you look at the color distribution of clusters, which are the small dots, and if you look at the color distributions of the low mass X-ray binaries, which are the red dots, each of these color distributions, these are WIFPIC2 data of globular clusters, each of them is bimodal. So there's one peak here, there's one here. It's divided here, that's the blue peak, that's the red peak, that's the blue, that's the red, there's the blue and the red. In each case, you see many more low mass X-ray binaries in red clusters than you see in the blue clusters. It's a factor of 3 over density. And this has also been seen by many other groups, Kim et al., Sivakoff et al., and there are other papers too, but these two have, they've done large surveys. So, as I said, the numbers that we got from 4472 also hold up for the overall population, that 45% of low mass X-ray binaries and ellipticals and S0s are in clusters, and 4% of clusters host low mass X-ray binaries brighter than 10 to the power 37 Erds per second. But the surprising thing in that plot is this is NGC 1399. So this is the color distribution. This is the blue. This is the blue peak of the color distribution. This is the red peak of the color distribution. So you can see that the low mass X-ray binaries are not only in the red peak in this particular galaxy, but they actually clump up at the red end of the red peak. So what that tells you is there is a difference in metallicity within the red peak. So you have a metallicity gradient within the red peak of the globular clusters. And so this is kind of interesting because we've been trying to do this with many different ways, looking directly at globular clusters by people do spectroscopy, people do infrared observation, but you never really get a signal that's statistically very significant. But in this odd way, this is kind of what you expect. If you have hierarchical galaxy formation, you expect there will be a gradient in the metallicity, because if the metal-rich clusters are mostly associated with the bulk of when the stars formed, you have lots and lots of interaction, then you would expect a metallicity gradient. So I would argue this is about the clearest evidence that you have of gradients within the metallicity population of the metal-rich metallicity population of a high-mass galaxy like NGC 1399. And just to show that it wasn't anything particular in that particular filter that we observed, I went down and I got some ACS G and Z data, and I put them up. And essentially you see the same thing. There's a bunch of clusters that really line up at the very end here. So there is a gradient within this peak. So what we did recently is we went out and we got some data at the ISPI, which is a 10 arc minute infrared array on the CTIO telescope. And we looked at the Sombrero galaxy. So there is some evidence in the Sombrero galaxy. They don't completely line up, but you basically see the effect of metallicity. So the correlation increases in this direction or increases in this direction. By the time you go up to the corner of the color magnitude diagram, there's 100% chance of finding a low mass X-ray binary. We kind of saw this even in our earlier data for just from the optical data without going through the infrared, that some of the brightest low mass X-ray binaries, to first order, there's absolutely no correlation within the brightness of the low mass X-ray binary and the type of cluster they are in. But if you look at the very brightest ones, they preferentially happen to be in the reddest and the most luminous globular cluster. So I've always argued that if you work out the statistics, there's a chance that you have multiple, in fact, you almost have to have multiple bright sources within this cluster, which is not something that you have in the Milky Way. Even my collaborators and I differ on how significant that is, but I just wanted to mention it. So I'm not going to go through the models. All I'm going to say is there was no a priori reason to expect that you'd have this color correlation. And so after we saw this, we put out a model with irradiation-induced winds, and Natasha Ivanova had another one for convective layer variation with metallicity. And there are predictions for both of them, and there are some pieces of evidence that support maybe each of them at some level. But we really need more theory observations, more theories to explain the observations, basically. This is one of the predictions of our model, is that the spectrum should be different between the, it should be harder for the low mass X-ray binaries that are in metal poor clusters than in the metal rich clusters. So we have seen it in one galaxy, in the clusters in one galaxy, 4472. Effectively, you saw it in M31 in a paper that Jimmy Irwin wrote a few years ago. We have since looked at it with other data, and the results, admittedly, are mixed. So I don't think we have a workable model as yet. Okay, so now I'll move on to the second part of my talk, which is things called blue tilts, which are essentially mass metallicity relationships in globular cluster systems. And what I want to know is, how much do the properties of the blue clusters vary with whatever cluster parameters you have in mind? In the last few years, there have been ACS observations of the cluster systems of galaxies that are relatively nearby and not so nearby. And in each case, people make a color magnitude diagram. You see this bimodal globular cluster color distribution. These are the red clusters. These are the blue clusters. Same here. And the claim is that if you look at the blue clusters, there is a slope here. And as the blue clusters become more massive, they become redder. And if you interpret color as evidence of metallicity, that means the more massive clusters are more metal rich. So there's basically a color metallicity trend. And the argument has always been, since you don't see it in the red clusters and you see it in the blue clusters, this must be something unique about the blue clusters. They retain their metals, their second generation, they have dark matter halos. You can go on and on. There's many different models. It's something along the lines of the kind of things we heard in the last couple of days. And so that's the basic outline of what a blue tilt is. There's a few other people who have found it. Spittler has found this in ACS observations of the Sombrero galaxy, and in his case, the Sombrero is nearer, I'll remind you, he sees not only a blue tilt in the blue clusters, but he also sees a slight blue tilt in the red clusters, which is kind of different from all the other papers before this. So this is different color combinations, and he still sees it. Stefan Majewski looked at the ACS Virgo cluster survey of galaxies, and he basically says it's the same thing. Now, this is a really weak effect, but the first time I saw it, I didn't think people would be taking it very seriously when you have scatter plots well within the error. But somehow it really took off, and everybody decided that this was a real effect. And there's many, many papers that's been written about this. And there's differences in the interpretation. Harris et al., who look at galaxies that are further away, see the effect in the brightest few globular clusters, brightest few magnitude. The other studies claim the effect can be seen to much lower masses. And in the case of in Spittler's case, he claims he sees it all the way down as far as he observes things. So here are a few of the features of this blue tilt of the mass metallicity trend. So metal poor clusters show the blue tilt, and it's either absent or it's much weaker in the red metal rich clusters, is what the claim is. The effect is stronger when the luminosity is plotted against the redder band. So if you plot it with Z band here, for example, that is G and Z. If you plot it with a Z band, it's actually a stronger effect. I think you can't even tell here. But if you plot it with a Z band, it's a stronger effect than the G band. It's a really small effect, but people take it seriously. So bear with me here. It's stronger in the inner regions of the galaxies, according to Majewski et al., and it's stronger in the more massive galaxies. And Majewski basically divided his sample into three luminosity ranges. And notice that by the time you go to the really low luminosities, you start getting things that go more or less in the opposite directions, in opposite direction. So what I did was I downloaded the same ACS Virgo cluster survey one orbit data of M87 that everybody else has been observing. And I reduced the data. Let's just ignore this for the moment. It's a way of throwing out things that are noisy, basically. And essentially, if you look at the color distribution, I see the same thing that everybody else does, is you see a correlation, a very small correlation. But mind you, the implied correlation in metallicity from this slope is larger than the larger than the metallicity trend in galaxies. The galaxy mass versus metallicity trend is actually weaker than this particular slope, as claimed. So next I ran a couple of experiments, which is I took a bunch of different filters. I took the same size filters in both, but I took 0.5, 1, 3, 4 pixel apertures, and I did the same color distribution. They look more or less the same. Now if you flip the filters around, if you take different size filters around, in this case you see, this is what I showed you initially, 3 pixel apertures. If I change the aperture ratios, I can actually make the blue tilt become larger, smaller, and I can make it go the other way. And you will notice what you should really look at is this distribution. These are the brightest clusters. Presumably they have the best photometry. So depending on what aperture I take, the distribution can go from this direction to the other direction in terms of mass and metallicity. Why does this happen? It happens because what I have done is just taken the difference between two apertures, a small aperture and a large aperture. There's no models involved. And the difference between these two apertures gives you an estimate of the size. And I plotted up the size as a function of magnitude. And what you see is there's a small size magnitude trend in both the blue and the red clusters. And there's a larger, the blue clusters are larger, this is well known. And so you see this line go up there. So what really happens here is, as your objects become slightly resolved, essentially, the light distribution is different because these are larger clusters than this one. And essentially, as you spread the light out, if you take the same pixel aperture, you get different ratios of light in the two filters. And as you become larger and larger, you will end up inducing a trend if you take equal apertures, which is what people normally do. There's also another thing that works, which is when you look at the uncertainties in CMDs, the uncertainties are not parallel to the axis. They actually go in the direction of the blue tilt. When you take the Z filter, they go opposite to the direction of the blue tilt when you take the G filter. And this basically weakens it or strengthens it depending on what you plot on the y-axis. The direction actually changes too. I did this by simulating a bunch of different sky positions. So I'm not going to... So the evidence that uncertainties actually work is, well, let me just not go through this plot. And what I did was I took this is a really deep data set that Chris Waters showed. And in one case, so this is a really deep data set. In one case, I substituted a shallow I-band data set and the blue tilt became larger. And the other case, I substituted a shallow V-band data set and the tilt actually became less. The other piece of evidence that the blue tilt is not real is Chris Waters showed this yesterday, this deep 50 orbits data. If you correct for the size of the distribution, then you essentially get no blue tilt in the distribution. If you take a median aperture for all of them, you get a blue tilt. This is the slope that people have found. So you basically get the same slope if you take the same median aperture. So people will argue, well, the first rejoinder is some papers fit the sizes, but most papers that do this is they're looking at much shallower data. You're looking at much shallower data, you basically are fitting at a much, much smaller radius. And past that radius, you basically just do an aperture correction. So there is information on the shape of the profile here. So you're never really correcting fully for the size until you have data that's deep enough to go down all the way. Second rejoinder. The mass metallicity trend is seen in distant galaxies where the globular cluster size couldn't possibly be resolved. This is Bill Harris's paper for 4696, which is like 30 or 40 parsecs away. The claim is that this is a blue tilt. Objects actually go off in this direction. So I did the same business of taking two different apertures for this data set. So in one case, if I take an unbalanced aperture, the blue tilt goes in this direction, then I flip it over, it actually goes. There are lack of sources up here. In this case, there are lack of sources up there. So some of these clusters actually have to be pretty large, or the PSF of the ACS varies with magnitude, and we don't want to go there. The third rejoinder is ground-based data show blue tilt. This is Werner et al.'s data using Gemini, and they claim to see a tilt here in the blue clusters and not in the red clusters. Ground-based data can have lots of problems, and there's a whole variety of things that happen in ground-based data. Firstly, this is 1399, and there's basically no blue tilt in this particular data set. There's none in the Milky Way too, and Strader says that in the paper, but he draws a line there anyway. This is Bassino et al. They have looked at galaxies in Antlia, which are also 30 megaparsecs away. This is VLT data. And essentially, this is as you go brighter, the cluster distribution actually becomes bluer. So it goes in the opposite direction. It's as far away. So you have a whole bunch of different data sets. This is M60 and M49 by Lee et al. They see a red tilt in the red clusters. They see a blue tilt in both the blue and the red clusters. This is another one by Forte et al. This is 1399. They see no blue tilt. They see M87, there is a blue tilt. But in this case, they actually made the mistake of publishing some other information. This is something like a size information. And if you plot it up with a magnitude, you see this is completely flat and there's something weird going on here. There's something in the data. I don't know what it is, but your photometry, your shape of the PSF should not vary with the magnitude of the object. And one final thing that I'll talk about is indirect evidence is, does the color of the blue clusters vary with the mass of the host galaxy? So Paul showed these plots. This is from my paper. This is from Strader et al. So the claim is there is a weak correlation between the mass of the galaxy and the color of the blue clusters. There's this beautiful plot in Eric Peng's paper where he basically just, this is the density, the brightness of the density of the cluster colors. And you can see the red clusters have a peak that go up there, the envelope goes there. If I look at this plot, I really don't see much of a trend there. But apparently if you fit this, you get a trend there. I haven't corrected this, but what you can do is, what I did was I picked out five. This is a very, there's a scattered trend. I just picked out five galaxies which followed the trend. And I just looked at the mean size of the blue clusters. And what I found is that the mean size of the blue clusters actually varied with the mean color of the blue, it varied with the mean color of the blue clusters. So essentially, if you correct for it, this trend might actually disappear. There's no such thing in the red clusters. The mean sizes were constant. This is an indirect piece of evidence, but if you can correct for it, then there might not be any variation between, I'm not going to show the Milky Way things, but I'm just going to leave the summary up there. So there's a couple of things that I talked about, that low-mass X-ray binaries are metal-rich clusters, and there's more low-mass X-ray binaries in metal-rich clusters. You see a trend within the metal-rich color distribution, which tells you that there's a metallicity distribution. And I'm going to make a very precise statement about the blue tilts and how universal the properties of the blue clusters are. I can't claim that there is no blue tilt. What I can claim is, within the uncertainties of the present data set, the colors of blue GCs appear to be remarkably uniform within and between galaxies. The between galaxies is indirect evidence. In as much as the colors reflect the underlying metallicity of these metal poor blue GCs, the properties of the metal poor blue GCs appear to be remarkably uniform everywhere, and they don't seem to have any knowledge of which halo they'll end up with later on. Thanks.
Thank you, Arnav. Okay, do we have any questions?
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. I'm guessing this is going to be a comment, but I'll give the microphone to you, Eric.
So, if I had my talk had gone after yours, I might have had to change most of it to address these some concerns I have. Now,
you should be friends with the organizers for that reason.
we've had many discussions, and I've talked to Chris as well about a lot of these issues that you brought up in the second half of your talk. And since I'm the representative of the group that's done a lot of the photometry that you've called into question, I had.
It isn't only your group. There are other groups.
I understand. I can't speak for other groups, but you know, I'm on some of the papers that you cite.
Yeah.
So I have 3 points. Hopefully they're brief. But the first is that I'm just worried that you've shown a lot of sort of circumstantial.
Chris's data is not circumstantial.
Right. But in the case of the. Oh, yes. I'm hoping that I can finish my comment. you've shown a lot of evidence that you claim calls into question the validity of the photometry generally by degrading the quality of your photometry and by degrading your signal to noise. And this this worries
me. The statement should be a fact. What do you mean by degrading? Photometry, there's no law of photometry that says that you have to take a specific aperture. You can take any aperture because the PSF, you're just taking, it's what fraction of the light you're correcting for.
No, it's true, but if I measure the central pixel and correct for it, I will have a lower signal to noise.
No,
I mean, it's just,
if you have, you will have higher, your signal to noise will be higher, but your precision will be lower.
Well, but for some of the, well, anyway, I don't want to get into the specifics of things.
If you take a central pixel, your signal to noise will be high.
Well, yes, but you have
to get, your
systematics will be, anyway, I don't want to get into a detailed thing. We've talked about this at some level, but I think one of the proper tests that you could do is something that we have done, which is to take a simple King model and convolve it with, you know, whatever PSF you think is an appropriate PSF or a range of PSFs, because then the main issue here is that the PSFs are different in the G and the Z bands, or in the V and the I bands, or whatever bands you pick, and the difference in sizes are what you're claiming is causing this bias. And you can do this test, and surely if you do take a small 4-pixel aperture or a 2-pixel aperture or whatever aperture, and you assume your object's point source and do a point source aperture correction, you will get the wrong answer with your magnitudes.
Okay, can May I answer the question?
Well, you can answer the, so that I haven't finished the second half of that point, though, is that the colors are what you're really concerned about. And the color, the difference in color that you can get between, in that kind of a bias, we've done this test. It's only 0.02 of a magnitude. So that's the reason why, even though we do our photometry using King models and we don't use simple aperture photometry, we get a consistent result with Strader et al. And with everyone else.
Okay.
So you can answer.
Okay. May I answer it now? Mm-hmm. Okay. So Strader et al., you and Strader et al. Get the same blue tilt. And Strader uses a plain old aperture correction. Now, you might have done the tests, but I can only go with what you have published. And the only thing you have published is you have shown that the mean half-light radius is more, you can actually recover the mean half-life radius. But when you are doing the fit, you have a rather low signal to noise, but you have tried to fit both the core radius, the half-light radius, and the total light. And it says on your paper that the fitting process is started with a 4-pixel aperture, and for most of the clusters, you actually fitted the 4-pixel aperture. So this is the only simulation I have that I can go with. There's a wonderful paper, let me show you this plot. So essentially you are going to 4-pixel apertures. What you are doing effectively for most clusters is you're going out here and then you're fitting the size. You might fit the size exquisitely within 4 pixels, I don't care. But the real problem is that the profile also changes outside. This is the same argument that Bill Harris has made to me saying that we have actually done PSF fitting. But you've done PSF fitting with this really small radius because your signal to noise is low, you can't go all the way out. And the real paper to note for this is there's a beautiful paper by Carlson and Holtzman. And they talk about this whole business of how you should fit if you're fitting three different parameters. And I'm just showing a few of their fits. And this is what happens to their chi-squares for the 24 brightest sources. And I'm just going to quote from them. From the simulations we find, we can measure King model concentrations to an accuracy of a factor of about 2 for all combinations of C and King radius, if and only if the data have a high signal to noise of 500 for the integrated brightness. For the lower signal to noise, marginally resolved King profiles suffer from a degeneracy. Different values of concentration give different King radius, but have comparable chi-squared values. In this case, neither the core radius nor the concentration can be constrained individually, but the half-light radius can be recovered accurately, which is all that you have shown here. Okay, let me just finish it once more. There's one other thing in your paper which I realized only after I talked to you 2 days ago is your paper is a 2-pixel drizzled data. There's only the ACS image has huge geometric distortion. As Ivan pointed out the other day, the pixel looks horrible. If, depending on where you put the object within a pixel, the profile changes completely. And if I understood your comment from a couple of days ago, you did not take the location of the center of the PSF within a pixel into account. And you can get completely different if you just take a PSF that's centered on a pixel and your object happens to be on the edge, you will get a completely different fit profile.
Yeah, that's not true.
Jay Anderson can answer that question.
Okay, so my quick rebuttal is, first of all, same data that Chris Waters has, and you showed those color magnitude diagrams. Could you go back to his plots? I'd like to say he doesn't actually use any more information than we do in doing aperture corrections, because his aperture corrections use his color magnitude diagrams. His aperture corrections use a 4 pixel minus 2 pixel
not
aperture.
This is the complete fit going out all the way out to this radius.
And the other thing is that, in his paper he doesn't. And if you show that again.
It does in the paper. You're just stating.
Chris?
Yes. He's right behind you.
Chris? Do you use the full King model fits for that color magnitude diagram?
For that color magnitude diagram, I'm going to switch right there.
No. So.
Can I jump in here as an organizer? let me remind everybody that we're here at the KITP.
I'm sorry.
I can assure you there's quite a number of people in the room right now, particularly theorists, who have been scratching their heads for quite some time, sort of wondering, what exactly is the big deal here? So let me rephrase this into a question, maybe more nicely. Tell us maybe if there were such a tilt.
Okay.
So what?
I'll tell you there's two reasons. I'll tell you there's two reasons why this matters. One is, there's this whole business of what is the mass metallicity strength? Do clusters actually know how massive they are? Do they retain how many stars? The second problem is I'm talking about colors. Colors are different only if magnitudes are different. If the colors are different, the magnitudes of the objects are much more different than the colors. We had great discussions a couple of days where we fit Schechter functions to things. But the high mass end, which is where most of this thing is happening, the high mass end can be quite different if the luminosities are different. So that's why it matters. So everybody's fitting all sorts of models to the globular cluster systems, but the entire luminosity distribution and the color distribution can be very different from what you think they are. And they can be very different at the really luminous end, which you always assume is correct. So the problem is high at the very, so that's why you should care.
Steve wants to chip something in over here.
So one is with the mass metallicity relation for globular clusters, if it's really there, which it's not in the Milky Way, this gives you a whole nother multiple populations issue, but now with iron peak elements. Of course, it's not there in the Milky Way, but the claim has been it's in there in some other galaxies. So that's important for how you form these things, if true. The second one is, as Aronoff said, it has how you determine those colors has implications for this. Now it's not an individual cluster mass metallicity relation, but it's a galaxy globular cluster system mass metallicity relation. And there's a mass metallicity relation for galaxies. The question's always been, do clusters follow it? Does that mean they know something about where they formed or not? Which you could then connect, for example, if you have sort of, you know, simple prescriptions how to put clusters in at high redshift, connecting them with metallicity, with like the density of the halo formation redshift, you can create or not create these relations if you believe that they're there or if you believe that they're not there. That doesn't make understanding how ACS photometry works any more fun for 90% of the people here.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll have time for one or two more questions that are not about photometric accuracy, if we have any. Okay, if not, let's go to the coffee break and let's thank all of our speakers first.